You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Eli.
Hey, Bob. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero newsletter, which I encourage people to check out. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Eli Lake, a longtime sparring partner of mine, also writer for the Free Press, host of the Breaking History podcast, contributing editor, commentary. You and I have had conversations in the past, often about the Middle East, sometimes about Iran. We've tended to disagree about Iran, but possibly never as clearly as we're going to disagree now. At least that's my guess. Because we're in the middle of this war, it was with Iran that was started by the U.S. and Israel. I think it was a really bad idea. You think it was a good idea. I think you can start out by correcting me if I'm wrong. I'd love to be wrong about that, but
I think that Iran has been at, I think the United States and Iran have been at war since 1979. And I think that the current kind of battle, the hostilities, began on February 28th with the decapitation strikes of the regime and Trump's 3 a.m. message.
Okay. So that maybe that obviates a question I was going to ask. Yeah. If you think the war's actually been going on since 1979, what I was going to say, I was going to bring up a subject that seems to matter a lot more to me than to the average person who talks about foreign policy in America. That's international law. I was going to say, I assume you're not bothered by what seems to me a clear-cut violation of international law here, but maybe you don't think it's... I was going to say, do you think it's not a clear-cut violation of international law for us to have attacked Iran, or do you just think international law shouldn't be of overriding importance?
Well, if you mean that international law says that you need a UN Security Council resolution to for one sovereign state to attack another...
Well, or at least that you should only attack in self-defense, which I don't think you can argue that the U.S. was, that this was an attack we launched in self-defense. And that's what the UN Charter says.
Yes. And I'm in agreement that the UN Charter and says that, and that this was done outside of it. However, my caveat would be that, you know, I think international law is in a pretty sorry state right now in the world. And states like Iran kind of exist outside of international law in many ways by their tactics. So, you know, I concede that the letter that, yes, clearly the UN Charter says that you need to have a UN Security Council resolution. And the United States did not obtain one. It's certainly not the first American war. It's not the first recent war. We have a lot of examples where, you know, this kind of basic of the UN Charter has not been observed. There are some international relations theorists that said, you know, it was never really in effect. But I would say it's really eroded a lot. But yeah, there's a huge difference. I mean, I'm willing to concede that. I mean, Colin Powell and George W. Bush and Don Rumsfeld, that administration more than 20 years ago tried very hard to get a UN Security Council resolution and ultimately relied on a kind of weird argument that there were other UN Security Council resolutions that were in the breach.
Right.
We don't have to rehash that now, but yes, we now are living in a different era. But I would also say that, you know, there have been a lot of wars that did not, you know, have the UN Security Council had nothing to do with. I mean, you could look at the Russian invasions of Ukraine. You could look at the U.S. intervention in Kosovo. You could look at the war in Libya. I mean, there's just a lot that's happened where it just feels a little bit like the UN Charter is pretty quaint, especially if you look at it.
But it is a treaty commitment by the United States. It's a treaty we ratified. So are you saying that we don't necessarily have to comply with our treaty commitments?
No, I'm not saying that you don't comply with the treaty commitments. What I'm saying is that the the status of the United Nations in general, I feel, is like kind of approaching League of Nations territory. There are aggressive states in the world. There are rogue states. And that I think that there's a sense here where, if we move to a slightly different issue, which is the constitutional question about should Trump have gone to Congress, even though I guess I'm on the hawkish side of it, I would say I think he should have. But again, that's another norm that's been violated, and that was violated before Trump as well. I just think that we're just in a different kind of period at this point, and that my vision of an international system that could work would be one with fewer members, but clearer kind of understanding that, you know, we are all agreeing to these sets of norms. But at this point, we don't really have that world. Okay, so,
I mean,
that's where I'm at on that. So I'm not, I know the UN Charter as you do. This violated it.
Yeah. And the last thing I'd say on that is, I think you said, no, you do think we should comply with treaty commitments, but we should have violated the UN Charter in this case. And I don't understand that, because this is a treaty. It's a ratified treaty. And by the way, you mentioned that this violates the U.S. Constitution because...
I'm not saying it violates the U.S. Constitution. I think that it violates the spirit of the War Powers Act. But okay. I think that's another norm that has been like eroded over time. Well, and I'm not a fan of multilateral treaties, I should say. So I like treaties with other governments. But I just think the problem here is that if you have a world where you have a number of states that just simply live outside of international law, it creates, I think, a problem to the, you know, sort of a danger to the commons and it's an overall danger if you sort of have some states that you expect to follow international law and other states like Iran that exists outside of an international law that at a certain point, you know, I think they've relinquished their sovereignty. I wish there was a process, and I don't know how it would work necessarily, because I think that, you know, its allies of, you know, China and Russia would have, you know, are permanent members of the Security Council, and they have a veto. But I think there should be a kind of process where a state, you know, like Iran, under the Islamic Republic regime, would kind of relinquish its sovereignty, which is to say they've violated so many things that at a certain point you can come in and do something about it. But that is not how international law works. But maybe if there was, in my ideal world, that's how I would have it.
Okay. I mean, one more point on the Constitution. The Constitution also says that the ratified treaties become, quote, the law of the land. So I would argue that violating the UN Charter, as you and I agree we did, is actually a violation of the U.S. Constitution. But you're using the word norm, it seems to me, kind of interchangeably with laws. There is a difference, but I would agree that compliance with the law is a norm, right? It's like there are lawless societies where people routinely violate laws, and in that case, the norm hasn't taken hold. I would say I agree with you right now in international law, in the world, the norm of complying with the UN Charter has eroded. You seem to think that Iran led the way or something. I would say no. The U.S., if you look at the post-Cold War world, which is the world that offered a chance to kind of restore the significance of the Charter and the UN and everything, because suddenly, there were things the U.S. and the Soviet Union, or then Russia, could agree on, and in fact did agree on. The Persian Gulf War was authorized by a vote that included China and Russia. If you look at that world, that new start we had with the first Bush administration, I would say it's the United States that's led the way in the violation of the Charter. The Panama invasion under Bush 1, as you mentioned, Kosovo. Yes, we violated the UN Charter before Russia did. And we had more normative power than any other country. We had more potential to restore and uphold the norm of compliance with the UN Charter than any other. And I would say we squandered it. If we're talking about the Charter, part of the Charter, it's about trans-border aggression, which I think is the heart of it. I'm not sure what violations on Iran's part you're talking about, but We have committed a lot of them, including the Iraq War in 2003, of course.
Iran is responsible for hollowing out the state of Lebanon by arming, funding Hezbollah. It's responsible for the Yemen civil war, the latest one, by arming and funding the Houthis. It's responsible, in part at least, for the horrors of the Gaza war because of its longstanding relationship with Hamas, although it was strained because Iran also then supported Bashar al-Assad when he was in the middle of his horrific slaughter with the use of chemical weapons against his own people. Iran is kind of a serial violator of international sanctions. Until the JCPOA, it had illegally pursued clandestine nuclear programs.
Israel's
not a member.
Go ahead and finish. I want to start at the beginning. Go ahead and finish, and we'll get to nukes.
All right. Well, I'm just saying, I mean, Iran, in every definition, is a rogue state. From its very beginning, the Islamic Republic, the revolution is, we see within a few months, they hold the embassy hostage. They send out assassins to kill the first interim prime minister. They have, we know from court documents, they tried to hire killers to try to assassinate Donald Trump when he was out of office, not to mention Masih Aliniejad. They have
You're against assassinating heads of state, right? You would not support any country that would do such a thing?
Well, I celebrated the ending of Khamenei and his various henchmen.
That's kind of my point, yeah.
Well, except I'm saying that, like, this for Iran, this is a behavior that goes back a long way. And part of the reason why I celebrate Khamenei's demise is precisely because of, their rogue and despicable kind of state behavior. I mean, like, there's a whole series of things, Bob. Okay. And I don't want to have to go through everything, but, like, you know that, like, you know, the Iranians were behind the assassination of, like, Kurdish dissidents in Germany and in Austria, on and on. It's like this whole list. They, Henry Kissinger, when he was alive, had a great kind of quip about Iran, which is that it has to decide whether it wants to be a country or a revolution. And it has tried to spread, an Islamic revolution, which I think is, an authoritarian kind of debased ideology that is in general is kind of hostile to things that I care about. And we haven't even discussed how it treats its own citizens, which is despicable. So I just look at everything that Iran does, and I really don't put it in the same category. In the case of Panama, you had a short war to remove,
Maduro,
a drug running dictator. In the case of Kosovo, you had a bombing campaign that effectively halted.
Noriega. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, Noriega. And you had a bombing campaign that effectively halted Slobodan Milosevic's efforts to cleanse Kosovo of its Albanians. I do think that, and I just want to make one other point that's kind of related, which is that we sometimes get caught up in this, but international law, as you know, not the same as a domestic law, because it relies to it. I mean, who enforces international law? And the United Nations does not have its own army. It relies on the United States to kind of carry the load. And so I just don't really look at international law in the same way, just because I think in that sense it's more ephemeral. So that's why I reject your effort to try to say we're the number one rogue state. And even in a case like Iraq, leaving aside that there was an effort to try to bring on the UN Security Council, it was not equivalent of like Russia's invasion of Ukraine. There was not an effort to, kind of occupy Iraq indefinitely and make it the 51st state. It was an effort to.
But we did occupy it.
Well, yes, but what do we do when we invaded Iraq? And I would note that I don't think there's any plan for like a serious.
Well, I don't want to get off on a.
But what do we do? We helped them write a constitution, and they've had successive elections. That's not what like Russia's doing in Ukraine.
We had elections that we kind of tried to put our finger on the scale of, and that's what Russia might do if they did ever seize control of Ukraine. But anyway, let me just give it the beginning. So you've said a lot of things about things Iran has done in the context of international law. I think some of the things you mentioned are not covered by international law. Let me say, what I was trying to focus on was the core of the UN Charter, the bedrock of international law, the trans-border aggression. And you started out by, in your list of Iranian crimes, by saying they hollowed out Lebanon by supporting Hezbollah. Well, as no doubt you know, Hezbollah's origins begin with Israel's invasion of Lebanon, trans-border aggression in violation of the UN Charter. Hezbollah begins as an organization of resistance against Israeli occupation. Does Iran see the opportunity to develop a junior ally? Absolutely. And we can talk about that, but it's just kind of ironic to me that the beginning of that episode is a clear violation of international law by Israel.
Why did Israel feel the need to invade Lebanon?
Because the PLO had found a home there.
And the PLO was conducting a number of cross-border raids and was threatening. I mean, like, the PLO was using Lebanon as a base to attack Israel.
Mm-hmm. Look, okay. Maybe it's conceivable that there's a stronger argument against my claiming that that was a clear-cut violation of law than I appreciate. But I would say Hezbollah's origins lie with the invasion and occupation of Lebanon by Israel.
From the very beginning, the Iranians were there with a mission, much the way the more aggressive, sort of side of Soviet foreign policy. At
well, do you agree that
Stalin, where they were trying to promote an Islamic revolution? From the very beginning, you're right. Hold on. I wanted to say, yes, you're right that it started as a insurgency against Israel's occupation of southern Lebanon. However, from the very beginning, they were also an instrument of Iranian statecraft. I mean, that there's a reason why this big scandal, the Reagan administration, involved sending arms for hostages. It was because the Iranians were getting the arms and instructing its clients to release hostages that it had taken. So I think that that shows something more than just sort of an organic group that Iran saw a moment of opportunity. And most scholars of Hezbollah today acknowledge that it is an extension of Iran. And as such, Iran gave it 100,000 or more missiles aimed solely for the destruction of Israel, which is like, you know, it was basically creating an Iranian kind of border with Israel. So that is what I mean. But more importantly, that to me, all of their activities, basically sponsoring an organization that is committed to the Iranian regime's goal, which is to destroy Israel, that places the security of Lebanon, the delicate political balance in great danger. And finally, we have a situation which is finally the case where you see leading members of the Lebanese government in the last 3 or 4 weeks have now finally said Hezbollah is an outlaw organization. They have expelled the Iranian ambassador. I mean, there's a reason why you're seeing these other Lebanese politicians finally saying enough is enough, because Iran basically, I would say, kind of had a sort of stealth or proxy invasion of the country.
Okay. Let me say just a few things in serial here. When you say Iran gave them weapons solely for the destruction of Israel, we can save this argument for later in the conversation. I'm sure you're aware of the view that actually from Iran's point of view, these, so-called proxy groups, I think in some ways that's a misleading term, but in any event, have a largely deterrent function. That is to say, their ability to threaten Israel was supposed to keep Israel from attacking Iran. And indeed, we saw that once Hamas and Hezbollah were completely degraded, Israel proceeded to start attacking Iran. So it seems that's not a crazy idea. We can save that argument for later. You brought up the nuclear issue in the context of international law. That's kind of confusing to me because Iran has not violated, the non-proliferation treaty, which Iran is a party to, does permit you to enrich uranium. We had a nuclear deal with Iran that allowed us a degree of transparency that no other nation has in terms of monitoring and surveillance. We knew what was going on there. Trump decided to pull out. Israel wanted him to pull out, and that helped get us where we are today. But the point is, it's not a violation of international law for them to enrich. And by the way, if they want to develop a nuclear weapon, All they have to do that in compliance with international law is give whatever it is, 3 months, 6 months notice that they're getting out of the non-proliferation treaty, and they do that. And in that case, they would have exactly the status in international law that Israel has, which is it has nuclear weapons and it's not a party to the NPT. So that is not, I think, a serious international law issue. Right, well, and I would say further, a lot of people ask, like, wait, why does Israel get nuclear? A lot of people in Iran ask this, why does Israel get nuclear weapons if Iran doesn't? I'd be delighted with a regional, like, nuclear-free agreement with intrusive inspections that Israel lets go of their nuclear weapons and there's no nuclear weapons in the region. That would be great. But I think a lot of people ask why Israel is entitled to get them, whereas if anyone else wants to get them, even in compliance with international law, Israel gets to just bomb the shit out of them in flagrant violation of international law. The last thing is on this assassination thing. I mean, come on. I mean, first of all, I'm not the various things you listed, some of them I'm not conversant in, some of them I am conversant in. I'm not acknowledging that there was any kind of that all of the assassination plots and or actual assassinations happened. I don't know in some cases, but I will say that surely you would agree. No nation has done more to normalize assassination, broadly speaking, heads of state, everybody else, than Israel, right? I mean, that's kind of what the movie Munich is about. You've seen the movie, right? Like after the Olympic, the Black September thing in the Munich Olympics, you know, these terrorists killed these Israeli athletes. It was a horrible thing. But Israel, decided.
The CIA and the KGB killed an awful lot of people. I mean, I don't know what to say. I mean, okay.
Well,
listen,
okay,
I don't want to get
anyway,
caught up.
But
I find that to be a
Iran.
Pretty.
All that was before. So you're saying, yes,
no,
it was normalized before Iran started doing it.
I didn't say that Iran was the only country that ever. I was listing all the things that Iran had done that, in my view, make it a rogue state. But let me just go back to the nuclear thing, because I think you've got some of it a bit jumbled. Israel became a nuclear power before there was an NPT and has declined to join the NPT. Israel is also not a declared nuclear power. And we don't. And the big concern that as a result of a sort of secret agreement in 1971 or 1970, I forget exactly what year, between the U.S. and Nixon and Golda Meir, was that Israel would not become a declared nuclear power. And as a result, it kind of worked because there wasn't a proliferation cascade in the Middle East. Everybody knows Israel has nuclear weapons, but only Iran has sought nuclear weapons. But I want to get back to the NPT. You're right.
Wait, what do you mean? First of all, they were not seeking. I mean, they abandoned a nuclear weapons per se program in 2003.
Before we get there, I want to just explain how Iran is a violator of the NPT. Because Iran violated the NPT by building secret industrial size enrichment facilities without declaring it to the International Atomic Energy Agency. This was the crisis of the first year of the Obama administration when the U.S. discovered Fordow. Before that, there was the discovery of Natanz. Now, the way the NPT works is that you're supposed to be up front. You're not supposed to build them in underneath mountains. And as Israel has learned when it found the secret archives of the nuclear program, and as the U.S. intelligence and the IAEA learned later, there was there were plenty of these sites that were for a nuclear program that were never declared to the IAEA. So that itself is an enormous violation. But let's just take a step back from that. Iran is a fanatic regime that is based on an ideology that is seeking to spread an Islamic revolution. That is what that, and they every day, death to Israel, death to America. So there's a difference between a country like that acquiring a nuclear weapon and a country like Israel or America or France having nuclear weapons. And so I don't like the fact that Pakistan has a nuclear weapon, but I would say the prospect of the Iranians getting a nuclear weapon is even like worse than Pakistan, which has a shady Islamist security force. So that's where I just think that like you're kind of glossing over things. And finally, I think it's very important. And so that's why when you sort of make this comparison, Israel develops a nuclear weapon before there's a non-proliferation treaty. They obviously decline to sign the nuclear non-proliferation treaty. Iran signs the nuclear and then, you know, is trying to cheat that nuclear proliferation treaty. So, I mean, it's that's where I would say it's apples and oranges.
As for Israel, I'm stipulating that Israel is in compliance with international law. My only point is that Iran can develop a nuclear weapon in compliance with international law if it gives the 3 months or 6 months notice of withdrawal from the NPT. That's all I'm saying. All now, right, as for Iran,
I
mean, itself,
I don't want Iran to get a nuclear weapon. Do you?
I'd rather they didn't, but okay. That was under control. We had that under control. And then Trump,
no,
with Israel's active support, got out of the Obama deal.
Yeah.
And with which Iran was clearly complying. And did you support withdrawal from the deal, which had this incredibly intrusive inspection and monitoring?
I'm being honest, at the time, I said that Trump should use the leverage of the threat to withdraw to get a better deal. But now, in retrospect, I'm in favor of it in retrospect. But at the time, I wrote columns saying that it was an opportunity that, to use American leverage to try to get a much better deal than what the... I mean, and I would just argue that I don't think that the Obama deal in any way got us out of the woods, because what it was relying on was a kind of promise. I mean, like, a good deal would have been to basically pursue the policy that we have, what was U.S. policy up to then, which is that you can have nuclear power, but you cannot enrich the power in your own country. And that was called a 1-2-3 agreement. That was what the United Arab Emirates basically agreed to. It's what a lot of other countries had agreed to. We make an exception to this kind of understanding because of Iran, that already, as I said, built up a massive industrial kind of enrichment capability. Now, my problem in the simplest terms with the nuclear deal was that it left that massive industrial enrichment capability in place. Mm-hmm. So Iran could become effectively a threshold nuclear power, mm-hmm. And still be in compliance with what it was, the Joint Comprehensive Framework, whatever, the JCPOA agreement. So that's the issue, that we're basically at the end of the process relying on the Iranians to just keep their word, which I think would have been a bad idea.
Well, no, I mean, the deal, the thing about it was, first of all, I mean, enriching it on their own soil, I don't think that was like a normative thing, right? Like that wasn't a violation of the NPT per se, but in any event,
I'm agreeing with you that the NPT allows for it.
Yeah, okay, by the end of Obama, that's all declared, and it was so transparent that, yes, I do think Iran wanted to, for strategic reasons, remain a threshold state. They thought that might help, for example, you know, defend against Israel, I think. And although I can't read their mind, who knows what they wanted. But the point is, we would know if they were breaking out and went on a headlong rush, thanks to the Obama deal, we would have known. And it would have been months and months before they could develop an actual nuclear weapon. And you would know.
Even Obama acknowledged at the end of the deal, it would be a matter of weeks. So that's not true. It'd be months and months.
Oh, I don't think that's true. To put it on a warhead? To put it on
it gets a little technical.
Look,
and my head spins from it too, but I'm saying, if you go back and you look at what the warehouse of archives that the Israelis liberated from downtown Tehran, you find that they had everything in place pretty much. And I don't buy I think that the 2003 assessment, by the way, that they were not, they'd chosen to abandon their path for a weapon, is based largely on a fatwa from the late Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei. And I would just point out that I think they would have they probably would have stayed to it. But the thing about, you know, fatwas in the Shia faith is that they die with the Ayatollah. And
and maybe you shouldn't have killed him, but anyway.
Well, okay, look, he was like eight. But my point is that I just think that the plan was to have everything in place and then either become a threshold nuclear net. But this gets to like a deeper point, which is that, again, I would like for there only to be one country with nuclear weapons, America. But there's a difference between Israel or, you know, England having nuclear weapons versus a country like Iran,
This is where I disagree. Okay. And I think you have to understand a lot of people do disagree. And I would just say it's far from evident that there's a clear cut difference between the two. And I would say that I think in general, what we've seen here is that you see such an obvious kind of moral distinction between Iran and Israel that it's just we have no compliance to act as if Iran, we have no obligation to act as if Iran is a normal state. But I think you need to at least understand the perspective that that's not obviously true, that if you were like this impartial observer on Mars, I mean, look, like right now you would look down and say, look, wait, Israel is at the moment, maybe you'll disagree with this terminology, but ethnically cleansing Lebanon, ethnically cleansing Gaza, ethnically cleansing the West Bank, a shitload of violations of international law. They bomb Syria at will, even after a friendly regime takes over, and so on. And I would say that if you go back a long way, even, and first go over the list of terrible things Iran has done, we go through them all and figure out, you know, which ones are well substantiated and which ones aren't or whatever. A lot of people would still go back and say, look, Israel has been committing what used to be considered atrocities for decades, like these assassinations and so on. I'm not even saying, and I want to emphasize, I'm not really taking that view right now. I mean, I think it has its appeal, but my main point is I'm not sure you appreciate how from just a fairly remote vantage point, it's just far from clear, especially in the wake of the last 2 years. But it's far from clear that Iran is a bad guy and Israel is a good guy. Now, I know if you're the average American, you take that for granted. I would argue that that's because our perception of Iran has been mediated by a media in America that is biased. And look, happens all the time. I would say the same thing about the Ukraine-Russia war. Ukraine's our ally. Israel's our ally. This slants our coverage
What? I'm sorry. There's a lot you've said.
Okay. Go ahead.
And I guess I would respond like this. It feels to me like the argument that you're making, and at one point you said, I'm not even saying but you're saying a lot of people are saying.
Well, for present purposes, I'm just trying to get you to step back and say,
I want to address the people who think that Israel's the bad guy or Israel's the terrorist.
I'm not even saying they're the bad guy. I'm saying it's not self-evident to a lot of people, including me, that Iran is a clearly worse actor than Israel. That's not clear to me.
All right. Well, it's very clear to me, but let me just explain what I think the error is in your kind of telling of recent history or the current state of things. When you talk about, first of all, like, let's just start with Gaza. Israel withdraws from Gaza in 2005. And as soon as Israel withdraws, there's this one sort of an interim period. There are elections and Hamas wins for the legislature. And then eventually Hamas conducts a kind of coup of the Palestinian Authority presence, I'm getting to it.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And as soon as Hamas takes control of Gaza, it begins launching a series of rocket wars. And those rocket wars then compel Israel to effectively close its border and try to, you know, monitor things that are coming in because they don't want the people, the sovereigns of Gaza, to have those rockets. Egypt also closes the border. And in that process, Hamas continues sort of treat the population of Gaza as a kind of human sacrifice because it's more important to Hamas to destroy Israel than to build anything approaching a state for the Palestinians who are so cursed to live under them. And ultimately, it culminates in October 7th, which, you know, was a kind of, I would argue, almost a national suicide mission because of the utter brutality of that rape and murder spree. In the case of Lebanon, you know, and I think there is room to argue about, you know, the tactics and the strategy, and there's all kinds of things. But on just a sort of moral level, it's not that Israel out of the blue is deciding to do that. Israel is responding to hundreds of rockets that are being missiles being fired by Hezbollah. And where do they fire their missiles and rockets from? They fire them from homes. This has been you know, documented over and over again, but it's basically kind of almost a mafia-like operation where they say, you know, we need you to put this in your garage or whatever, and when the time comes. So that is a reality that Israel has to deal with. So when they are going in, you know, I don't know how much of the ground for how long that ground force is, but and I would concede that Israel Katz is a terrible kind of international spokesman for the state of Israel, their defense minister. But, you know, there's a reason why they're going in and they're saying we've got to make sure that this whole area south of Latani is cleared because that has been a staging ground for these missile attacks, which basically makes the northern part of the country uninhabitable. You know, so that's, for me, I just think it's kind of a chicken and egg thing, which is to say Iran is committed to destroying Israel. It says, I don't think it has the capability of destroying America. It's a core part of its, of the regime's identity. And I'll go one further, which is that I actually think that they are, I mean, I think we've seen because there've been so many uprisings in, Iran, you know, since 1999, but I don't think that what the Islamic Republic offers, which has prioritized its pursuit of revolution and pursuit of the negation of the Jewish state, I think it's an anomaly in Iranian history. I think it's kind of un-Iranian, and that's why I don't think that that regime has legitimacy. But that's what Israel is kind of dealing with, so you can understand that it's very different than just a random state having a nuclear weapon. It's a state that is committed to Israel's destruction, trying to get a nuclear weapon. And the reason why I would say that the JCPOA was inadequate and a bad deal was because it basically allowed Iran to keep its nuclear industry. It allowed Iran, it lifted this any sanctions, so they were allowed to build up their conventional missiles, which go hand in hand with the threat of a nuclear weapon. And it infused it with cash, with all the sanctions relief, plus the cash bribe for the release of dual national Americans who had been unfairly held in Iranian jails. So it's like, that's why I don't want Iran to get a nuclear weapon, because the nature of that regime is very different than these others. Now, there are foreign policy realists, that's a school of thought, as you know, who think that the ideology or of a particular government or regime is immaterial. States pursue their interests. I don't buy that. I just think I think there's a huge difference between a state that is organized like Iran is today versus a kind of a normal nation state. So that's how I would put it.
Okay. A couple of things. For starters, in your Hamas narrative, when I said you left something out, I would encourage people to find a piece I wrote a couple of years ago now in Anon Zero. I think it's on the right column of the homepage because it was relatively favored by readers or something compared to my other stuff. And it's called The Truth About Hamas. And one thing it details, I'm sure you know the basics of the story, is that before the coup you talked about, what happened to us, America said, let's hold elections for a Palestinian government. So Hamas won the election. I mean, they didn't win a majority of the vote, but because of the way it worked and various things, they wound up in control of the legislature. And it was kind of a quasi parliamentary balance, system where there was the prime minister was going to have a lot of, you know, the legislature had a lot of power. So, well, we decided, you know, when we said explicitly, yeah, it's fine for Hamas to run. It's an election. But we didn't say they could win. So once they won, we, in effect, sponsored a coup against Hamas. And that led to this whole civil war. And there was this moment when it was being the civil war, there was mediation going on in Saudi Arabia, when the leaders of Hamas were saying some pretty damn moderate things. The truth is, neither the United States nor Israel, I think, wanted to follow up on those, so they didn't really get pursued. We'll never know what happened if we had tried at that point to nurture moderate elements. But anyway, I'd encourage people to read the piece, look into that.
Moderate elements of Hamas?
Well, I'm just saying they were saying a two-state solution was okay. I mean,
they weren't.
Well, look at what they said. Read my piece.
Okay, I'm happy to look at what they said. But Bob.
Yeah.
Let me offer a note of comity with a T. It was a massive error on the part of the Bush administration and also the government of Ariel Sharon, or maybe it was Ehud Olmert when the election happened. Hamas should have never been allowed to run in the elections. Full stop. And the reason I would argue they should not have been allowed to run in elections is because they were an armed faction, and that.
We gave them some of the arms.
They also shouldn't have run because we knew they were not committed to the democratic process. And by the way, now that's not a question of speculation. How many elections have there been since then? How many elections has Hamas held? None. So, I am not one of these people. Argument that some Israelis have made, which I disagree with entirely. Which is that, the people voted for Hamas. I say, no, the people voted for Hamas 20 years ago once, and they haven't had a chance to correct their error. And therefore, I see the Gazans as victims as of Hamas. And I've written a couple things on this myself where I've said, you know, this is a terrible situation for the average Gazan because they're double victims of both Hamas and the Israeli war. So I think that, you know, the empathy that we should have for Palestinian suffering should compel you to pursue real regime change. And one of the problems with the war fight, the wars, the rocket wars that led up to October 7th is that they were always, the theory of the Israelis was that we would just hit a bunch of things and bomb them and that would be a deterrent. I don't think you deter religious fanatics, authoritarian fanatics that way. I think that, especially since for them, and at least in terms of the battle space of public opinion or narrative battle space, the suffering of the people they purport to rule is a bonus. And we know this of how they decide, how they have chosen to fight and how they have built the tunnel networks that they don't allow their citizens entry into, after they conduct the horrors of October 7th. So my point here is only to say that we are in agreement insofar as they should have never been allowed to run an election. They're anti-democratic forces.
No, I didn't say that was my view, so we're not necessarily in agreement there. I think you're going to have an election, the outcome should be respected, and you should give the winner a chance to rule and see whether they're going to deliver on their promise to rule decently.
Let me put it like this. I agree that the Bush administration created a problem, and they should have, the mistake was allowing Hamas to run in the election.
Okay.
And I think the mistake in general was thinking that there was a way to moderate political Islam by allowing political Islamists to have power. I think we have to just come to terms that, like, political Islam is, and I hope that at the end of this conflict with Iran, there is no more Islamic Republic in that country, and it is relegated to the dustbin of history. But I think we have to, like, recognize that the Muslim Brotherhood and political Islam as a movement is a vicious and foul ideology that really does deserve to be, in the same, landfill as communism, Nazism, et cetera. And that's really, I think that was a big delusion. And I remember coming on the show after I was like in Egypt. And I remember saying, like, you know, because I'd met, you know, under Hosni Mubarak, the old dictator, I'd met members of the Muslim Brotherhood and they were charming. They spoke English. They understood politics. There were a lot of things I liked about the moderates that I met. And then if you kind of continue to follow the story, what you found is none of those moderates were part of what happened once they finally won an election. No, they were going full steam ahead. So my point is that we have to just understand that political Islam, the ideology of Said Qutb and Hassan al-Banna, you know, has run its course, and we really need to kind of move on. And we've already seen the Gulf monarchies have moved on. You know,
well,
I hope the Egyptians will move on. I think they basically have, although it's not a democratic country under Sisi, but
yeah, you know, could have been, but we didn't.
But that's the problem. This is the scam that the Islamists play. They pretend when they're out of power to like democracy, and then once they get power, they hate democracy.
We can't have that argument, but I certainly don't think the problem with Egypt before the coup that we implicitly supported. I certainly don't think the problem was that the Muslim Brotherhood leader was showing that he just couldn't live with democratic constraints. But in any event, so we've been doing this for close to 50 minutes. Now we're going to go into overtime. This is the, that's available to paid subscribers to the Non-Zero newsletter. Before we do that, I want to do a couple of things. Three things, probably. I want to remind people that your stuff can be found at the Free Press, which I am not going to call a Barry Weiss propaganda outfit, because that would be totally unlike me to treat any guest with that kind of discourtesy. Okay? So do I get credit for not saying that?
You sort of said it, but okay.
Actually, that reminds me, we could talk about her in overtime. Let me write that down. Also, and your podcast, Breaking History.
Yes, where we're filling in with some interviews, but when we get back to our regular seasons, we're going to do
right.
It was two seasons. It's a narrative podcast, so it's
right.
I do a
it
lot
was
of work.
Very highly produced under its previous yes. name, which I forget. But anyway, it's back yes. And there's people can check out your conversation with Andrew Sullivan. It appeared on his podcast, but on his podcast, you run into a paywall. It's kind of like this podcast, except you run into it earlier. You, in contrast, pirated the entire thing and put it on your feed.
Well, with the blessing of Andrew.
Okay.
Yes.
So then the other thing I wanted to do is I'm gonna give a few kind of bullet point replies, largely by way of foreshadowing what I want to pursue in overtime, then give you a chance to do your bullet point replies to my bullet point replies. I reserve the right to say, okay, that bullet point's over in the middle of your bullet points if they start seeming like paragraphs.
Fair enough.
Okay. So let me say, I was delighted to hear you use the phrase chicken and egg. It's kind of a chicken and egg thing. I may have not understood the context, but I think that is true of this whole thing, Israel, Palestine, and so on. It's if you're trying to say, well, one guy is the bad guy and the other is a good guy, it just depends on where you start the history. Because both sides, whenever you say you did this horrible thing, they can say, okay, but right before that, you did this horrible thing. And it really is a question of where you start this story. I think much the same can be said between Iran and Israel. You I think don't, but that's something I will pursue. Quick point on Lebanon. This is a little maybe a little cheap, but they're in addition to invading, you've probably read or are familiar with the book Rise and Kill by Ronan is it Bergman?
Yes.
You know, it's just because I say this only because, you know, you make a big deal of all of this horrible stuff Iran has done. One thing Israel did was they started this campaign of they created this fake group that was supposedly a Lebanese group of some kind. And then Israel, like, they would like plant a bomb that would go off in a parked car and kill people and attribute it to this group. Then this fake group would come out and say, we did this. No, Israel did it. And I'm just saying, like, you got to go back.
I'm not familiar with that part of the book. I haven't read it in a while, but I'll.
No, you should check it out.
Okay.
So on Hamas, the issue I want to get to about Hamas ultimately is the generic issue I want to get to is the meaning of the term proxy. I mean, Trump has talked as if Iran. I think he thinks, I mean, who knows what's going on in Trump's brain? I think he thinks Iran actually did October 7th, like it was Iranian troops. I think October 7th, let me just say the generic point is that proxies always have an agenda of their own is what largely motivates them. There is some convergence of interest with their sponsor, and sometimes they do things at the behest of their sponsor, but sometimes they just do things because they want to do them, and their sponsor maybe doesn't try to stop them or whatever. And I think there's a tendency to, on your side of the argument, Eli, to look at everything Hezbollah or Hamas has ever done and treat it as if it were an Iranian initiative when it's not always. I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. You mentioned, you said Iran is, they're religious fanatics. Well, a lot of people would just say, well, wait, look at the current Israeli cabinet. Come on, this is getting out of hand. You have true, crazy religious fanatics, Ben-Gavir, Smotrich, and they're doing horrible things. That would at least be the reply. Anything else in my... Well, I think there's an issue of kind of essential. I am more optimistic about the chances of changing the character of any political group over time than you are, but that's a philosophical difference. Okay.
All right.
Do your bullet points.
Quick bullet points. Okay. Yeah. I know it's the case in Lebanon, but I think it's also the case in Gaza that Israel has found and killed pretty senior Revolutionary Guard Corps officers who were there kind of giving on the ground guidance. And then also the weaponry.
Wait, you mean guiding October 7th?
Well, I'm just talking about a pretty, it's not just a, we write a check every year.
No, it's a true. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
It's a true sponsor,
Right.
In the sense that America Israel is sponsor client, kind of, but they do again, shit we don't want them to do. Go ahead.
Again, because the non-zero, formerly Blogging Heads, is not a television debate show where everybody just kind of. I will concede that what we basically know is that the planning for October 7th was, I think, largely kept in house and was a surprise. To I think even Hamas leadership who were in Qatar, although that may change as we learn more, but my understanding is that is the understanding now. And but I'm less inclined to I see your point that sometimes proxies can do things without the knowledge. I mean, so I concede that. I mean, I don't think Khamenei knew that October 7th was in the offing, but they certainly celebrated, but more importantly, I mean, Hamas would not have the ability to do that had it not been for years and years and years of nurturing, guidance, et cetera, from Iran. Okay, and then what was the point that you made about chicken and egg?
It begins on when you start the story.
That's fine. You had another point there you were making about what was the other one that you made? Maybe
I made a little point about, well, no, that is not.
Ben-Gavir and Smotrich. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. There's very important difference. I'm not going to defend Ben-Gavir and Smotrich, who have important positions in the Israeli cabinet. I've said this many times before. I think they are Judeo-fascists in the same sense. But the difference is that, there was Israel has elections. The Israel's government can change. Iran, they have kind of elections, but they don't really matter because the power resides with the supreme leader. Even their parliament, their majlis, is can be overruled by a council of experts, the Guardian Council. And there is a much longer kind of history that, if you read Khomeini's book, Islamic Governance, that, the structure of the Iranian regime is such that there was no opportunity for somebody who might be more moderate on these issues to gain actual control over their armed forces, Revolutionary Guard Corps, etc. So that's where I think that your analogy fails.
Okay. With that, we can head into overtime. I want to discuss the question. And the higher level, more abstract version of that is is Iran or is it not a rational actor in a way? I think
Yeah, I saw you wrote something on this, and I, all right, so why don't you start off and make your
point. Okay, so thanks everybody who stuck with us this far. The way you can listen to the rest of this is by becoming a paid subscriber to the Non-Zero newsletter.